very much. No, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, Bob, and wonderful audience, and it's great to follow Alan Millard, who I always enjoy hearing him and his wonderful writings and wonderful work, so thank you very much. So this is a long-standing puzzle, right? Joshua's Long Day, and many of you will be familiar with it, some of you won't be, so let's just see what the Bible says. Okay, so this is three verses from the book of Joshua, which describes Joshua's long day. On the day when the Lord gave the Amorites over to the Israelites, Joshua spoke to the Lord, and he said in the sight of Israel, "Sun, stand still at Gibeon, and moon in the valley of Ajalon." And the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, until the nation took vengeance on their enemies. Is this not written in the book of Jasher? The sun stopped in mid-heaven and did not hurry to set for about a whole day. There has been no day like it before or since, when the Lord heeded a human voice, for the Lord fought for Israel. So that's taken from the New Revised Standard Version, but all modern translations of the Bible, going back to King James, so starting in King James, coming up, they say it's actually the same thing. And the question is, can we believe it? Is this, you know, is this ancient fake news? So next slide. So this shows a map of the situation. Let's place this in a geographical context. So we had a question about crossing the River Jordan and entering Jericho. And what had happened was Joshua had led the Israelites, of course Moses had led the Israelites out of Egypt. Moses died, Joshua led them into the promised land. And the Israelites came up on this east side of the Dead Sea, and they went up the River Jordan, and they crossed opposite Jericho, and that was in the spring. And then later that same year, they encamped at Gilgal, and Joshua spoke these words to the Israelites and made this prayer to God that the sun would stand still at Gilgal. And then they marched across to Gibeon, where the Amorites were camped, and they made a surprise nighttime attack on the Gibeons, on the Amorites, and the Amorites fled. And if you read the verses below this in Joshua, the ones we read the following verses, the Amorites fled, and they did this route, and these places are mentioned in a biblical account, and at the end of the day here, but they had battles along the way, at Azekah and Ajalon and so on, with the Israelites. And that happened later, the year that the Israelites had entered Jordan. So the same here as the conquest. Next slide, please. And then, after reporting the sun stopped, the book of Joshua says the sun did not tarry to set for a whole day. So here's a piece of fake news to start with. And Harold Hill, who was president of the Curtis Engineering Company, and who claimed to be a consultant to NASA, and on occasion he claimed to be an employee of NASA, said that he had been present when NASA computer scientists had been plotting the course of the moon and the sun in their orbits in the future and also going into the past, and they discovered a missing day in the past. And he said they were all astonished by this, but there was a Christian in the group, and the Christian said, "I can tell you what this is. This was a missing day of Joshua." And so they all accepted this, and then the calculations were fine. And Harold Hill said he witnessed this, he was there when this happened, and he gave talks all over America. He then published a book in 1974, and that had a lot of publicity, and one of the headlines in national press in America was, "NASA discovers a lost day in time." It was this missing day in the book of Joshua. NASA then investigated this, and they issued a press release to say that they were aware of Harold Hill. They had taken engine components from his company, but he had never worked for them. He was not a consultant with them, and he had never talked with the NASA scientists who are responsible for these calculations and computations. So he basically made this story up. So that was fake news. And you can still find this on the internet. You can still find people saying it and recounting it because it had a lot of publicity at the time. Next slide. But can the Joshua story be true? And at first sight, it sounds impossible. And if it happened, it happened about over 3,000 years ago, as Alan said. And most people and indeed most biblical scholars believe the story is a legend. It sounds impossible, it sounds too good to be true. Next slide, please. And this is Dave Linson Brewer, who is well known to many of you and who spoke at previous meetings. So it's a very conservative scholar. Even conservative scholars struggle with this story. So Premier of Christianity had an article the title was Embarrassing Biblical Text, Embarrassing Bible Text. And then the subheading was, does God really make the silence stand still? And then the next heading was, David Attenborough tackles Joshua 10. This is what David said. We must distinguish between scripture and non-scripture. Joshua 10:13 quotes the book of Joshua. This may be an exaggeration. So he's having problems. He's saying that maybe the scripture doesn't actually say this. The book of Joshua says it in quotes. But if you go back and read what we've just read, it does say this was said in the book of Joshua, but that's like, you know, additional information. You can go and check there. And also it's quite clear that the book of Joshua is saying, after he mentions the book of Joshua, Joshua says these things really happened, the sun really did stand still and the moon stood still in our translations. So scientific problems of the sun stopping. So the first thing I think nearly all of us would agree with is an all-powerful God can do anything. But the important point is, we shouldn't ask the question, what could God do? Because we believe all-powerful and can do anything. The question is, what did God do in different circumstances? And if the Earth stops, it's a real problem for science. Sorry, if the sun stops, a real problem for scientists, because we see the sun going around the Earth every day. It rises in the east, sets in the west. But we now know what's happening is, this is because the Earth is spinning on its orbit, and the Earth rotates once every 24 hours, and that's why the sun appears to go around the Earth. And so if the sun stops, then what actually would have to happen is the Earth would have to stop rotating on its axis. And one thing which is quite astonishing to many people here probably is, you can work out, if the sun is rotating on its axis once every 24 hours, you can work out the speed of someone on the equator who's going around the Earth. And it's 1,000 miles an hour. And we're a bit, you know, north of that, and Earth's radius in the circle is getting a bit smaller. We rotate about 500 miles an hour. And it's quite, that's an astonishing fact of science. So everyone in this room, you're all rotating at 500 miles an hour. And the chairs you're sitting on are rotating at 500 miles an hour. The floor is going around. So, you know, it's relative motion. So none of us is aware of this. We've all grown up and come over many years to the existence, rotating at this sort of speed. The problem is, if the sun apparently stops, it means the Earth stops rotating, and we would fly through the air, and there'd be huge numbers of deaths. So just imagine if you're a car going at 70 miles an hour on a motorway, and a car suddenly hits a brick wall, then the occupants are probably killed. Because, you know, you keep on going, if a car has to stop, you keep on going at 70 miles an hour, and you're killed. And there'd be massive tsunamis worldwide, there'd be huge destruction, and there's no evidence of this. So this is the sort of scientific problem with this story. So next slide, please. Just as part of the introduction, this is what Augustine had to say about miracles. So he's a great Christian scholar, Bishop of Hippo, and what he says is, a long time ago, miracles are not contrary to nature, it's only contrary to what we know about nature. So if he was speaking today, writing today, he'd say, miracles are not contrary to science, only contrary to what we know about science. And when we know better science, we'll be able to understand the miracles. Now, I don't think this is totally true. I think it's true in many, many miracles. I don't think it's true with resurrection, because with resurrection, I think, you know, and other miracles, healing miracles of Jesus, scientific laws do appear to be broken. And certainly with our present knowledge of science, it's hard to see that's not the case. But just in passing, just to say, just as a great composer has the key signature for his music, but because he's a great composer, he's free to break that and introduce accidentals if he makes better music. So God, the great composer of the universe, is free to introduce accidentals and break the rules he's established if it makes better sense. And indeed, the resurrection made better sense because, as Peter said on the day of Pentecost, you know, the grave couldn't hold Jesus. Jesus was the Son of God, the grave couldn't hold him. So to resurrect Jesus made better sense. And so God can break his own rules, as it were, if it makes better sense, because it's the composer of the universe. But nevertheless, I think with all miracles, we should first have to see if there is a scientific mechanism. They're still miracles, but it's the timing which is most remarkable. So let's continue to look at this this statement through the eyes of science. So one of the most difficult passages of the Bible, I give a number of talks on science and faith. In about a third of those, whatever I've been talking about, I'm asked what happened with Joshua and his long day. And I've always replied, I'm sorry, I just do not know. I said, there's probably some explanation, but I do not know. And I thought just a few years ago, what I should really do is look and see what the Hebrew really says. Of course, I should have done that before. We should all do this in the Bible, difficult passages, see what the Hebrew text or Greek New Testament text really says. So this is what the Hebrew says. The sun stood still, and the Hebrew word used for that was dom, and the moon stopped, and the Hebrew word for that was mad, until the nation took vengeance on the enemies. There has been no day like it before or since. I mean, clearly it was a very special day that Joshua's reporting about. The Hebrew word dom means silent, dumb, or still. And in the Bible, it is translated in these ways. The Hebrew word mad means stop or stand. Next slide, please. And all English translations of dom have assumed that it means the sun stopped moving. Next slide, please. So, dom means silent, sun or still. So what does it mean if the sun is silent? So what does it mean if I'm silent? It means I stop speaking. So if the sun is silent, it stops doing what it normally does. It stops shining. So I wondered if it was... next slide, please. I wondered if this was the true meaning. And again, a mad means stopped. And the Bible translations assume it means stop moving. But could it mean it stops shining? So, I'm delighted Alan Millard's here, because at this stage, I contacted Alan Millard and said, Alan, I've had this sort of idea, could it be that the sun stops shining instead of stop moving? And Alan said, Colin, yes, this is a very valid interpretation, but it was said 100 years ago by a scholar, a linguist at Princeton University called Robert Wilson. So, a number of you are scientists, and I'm sure you all know the feeling when you think you made some discovery, and then you find someone else did this 10 or 20 years ago. So this person did this 100 years ago. And he said the Hebrew words mean the sun stopped shining. And he went further than that. He said in Babylonian cuneiform text, there are words with the same root as the Hebrew word dom, that are used in their astronomical tablets, specifically to describe solar eclipses. So we're saying in the Babylonian text, the words they use for solar eclipses have the same root as dawn. And then he says in his paper, the sun stood still should be translated as the sun's eclipse. So he, as a linguist 100 years ago, said the sun stood still is not the optimum translation of the text. The optimum translation is the sun's eclipsed. So as a solar eclipse, we know that the sun does stop shining, and those of you who are scientists will know that the moon also stops shining, so you can't see the moon. So the solar eclipse is Earth here, then there's the moon, and then there's the sun over here, and so you can't see the moon because it stops shining, the sun's shining on the back of it, not on the front of it, so we can't see it shining, and then we can't see the sun shining because the moon is in between the Earth and the sun. So they're both you can't see. So the best translation of the Hebrew is the sun was eclipsed. And then someone followed up this paper by Robert Wilson, and they said, unfortunately, we can't do the calculations. We can't calculate eclipses which might have been around in 1000 BC, and that was 100 years ago this year. Next slide, please. Let's just have a look at the sorts of dates we're talking about. So there's Pharaoh Meneptah, who was the son of the famous Ramses II. He erected a stela, this large granite, slab of granite on which the inscriptions were made. And it's now in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. And he says on the stela, it was carved in the fifth year of his reign. and it mentions his campaign in Kenya, in which he defeated a number of peoples, including a number of including the people of Israel. And so this means it's really nice evidence, really good external evidence. The Israelites must have been in Canaan by the fifth year of Meneptah. So it's really nice extra biblical archaeological evidence that the Israelites were there then. And so we can now go to some scientific evidence. This is a paper by Brock Ramsey and others in Science in 2010, where they did an extremely careful analysis of radiocarbon dates from many specimens from Meneptah, from Ramesses II. And they got out dates really careful, put them very careful with radiocarbon analysis, they were very, very careful. And they said, from the radiocarbon analysis, the first year of the reign of Meneptah, the first year of his reign, was in the period 1231 to 1207 BC, and they said we have 95% probability that this is correct from science, a really high probability. So that's the first year of his reign in that time period. The Steeler says the Israelites were in Canaan during his first 5 years. The latest date of Meneptah's first year was 12,007 BC. So the latest date for his fifth year was 12,003 BC, remembering that the ancient Israelites counted inclusively. So you count 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 for 5 years. So the sun stops shining. In the first year, the Israelites enter Canaan. I consulted Adam Miller again on this. So I said, if the crossing of the Jordan was in the spring, as it was this later the same year? And if you read the biblical text, then their battle with the Amorites was just later that same year. So the sun stops shining the first year, as I said, in Canaan. So the latest possible date of the eclipse is 12,003 BC. Next slide, please. So although when Bob Wilson made his pronouncement, made his assessment of the solar eclipse, people at that time, 100 years ago, couldn't do the accurate eclipse calculations. As time moved on, the astronomy improved, and I think it's John Sawyer in 1972 followed up the suggestion in Wilson, he made in 1918, that Joshua Tengah returns to a solar eclipse, and he calculated the dates of all total solar eclipses visible from Gibeon in Canaan between 1500 and 1050 BC. This huge date range, just taking into account all possibilities, as it were, for when Joshua might have entered Canaan. And he found there were just two solar eclipses visible from Canaan in that period of time. One was in 1157 BC, and one was in 1131 BC. The problem is that both of these dates are too late for the latest possible date for Joshua to have entered Canaan. Perhaps you have the previous slide, please. So, although when Sawyer did the calculations, they didn't have this radiocarbon dating, nevertheless, there was a traditional Egyptian chronology then, and the latest possible date for the eclipse from the dating we now know, but also at that time we knew roughly, was 12,003 BC, and the dates of the eclipses, total eclipses visible, well, were both later than this. And so it's too late for Joshua entering Canaan. So because of this, biblical scholars ruled out this solar eclipse interpretation very reasonably, and it's sort of become forgotten about. I've looked at a range of commentaries on Joshua 10, and the ones I've looked at, which are a lot of them, they don't refer to this eclipse interpretation at all. It's just been forgotten about because it doesn't seem to be possible. Next slide, please. So I was convinced that this seemed a reasonable interpretation. And then I had a thought that maybe Sawyer missed an eclipse. And I looked at his calculations and he didn't miss an eclipse. But what he did miss was to look at what are called annular solar eclipses. So today we distinguish between three different types of eclipses. There's total, annular, and partial solar eclipses. Total eclipse is when the moon obliterates the sun, but you still see the ring of a bright ring called the corona around the edge in a total solar eclipse. In an annular eclipse, the moon again is directly in line with the sun, but its distance from the Earth is different, so it doesn't totally obliterate the distance of the sun. In an annular eclipse, you just see a thin ring of the sun around the edge. In the ancient world, although we distinguish between total, annular, and partial, in the ancient world, they had the same word for total and annular. So total and annular to them was a total eclipse. They had total and annular the same word for partial. So their total eclipses included the annular eclipses. So I then worked with a very good astrophysicist, Graham Boddington. I've worked with many for many occasions when I've done other calculations. And I said to him, can you calculate if there are any annular eclipses visible from Canyon in the same time period we looked at, as Sawyer had looked at. And what he found was there was one only annular eclipse visible, and that was on the 30th October 1207 BC. And that is earlier than the 1203 BC, you know, deadline for that the Nectar Stele has for the Israelites entering Egypt. And this eclipse passed directly over Canaan. So if you believe this eclipse interpretation, we actually have a unique solution, and that is this particular eclipse on 1207 BC. Next slide, please. And this shows you the path of the eclipse. This is the path of totality of the eclipse. And the eclipse actually is coming in this direction. This is Sinai Peninsula there, and this is Palestine, Israel, Palestine here. This little circle dot marks Attica, where we believe the Israelites were when this eclipse happened, and it's sort of almost bang in the center of totality. This is a totality region. If people are awake, you may notice this actually says 1206 October 30, and that is because the astronomical calendar has no year zero, right? So the astronomical calendar goes minus 1 BC, 0 AD 1, whereas our historical calendar doesn't have a year zero. Have a second, right way around. Astronomical calendar has a year zero. Historical calendar goes straight from 1 BC to 1 BC to AD 1, you know, AD 0, and that's why. So that's astronomical calendar. This is a standard calendar here, right? Julian calendar. So that's the path of the eclipse. On the next slide, please. And this shows you what an annular eclipse looks like. This was a picture, photograph one, in 2012, in New Mexico, and you just see this little ring of the sun. But a total eclipse, that's blotted out a bit, you still see a sort of bright corona around it. So it's very similar in what you see. And the important point is that the light from the sun is hugely reduced in an annular eclipse, light falling on the Earth in the same way as in a total eclipse. So we have a unique solution, one of one only total annular solar eclipse visible from Canaan in this period, 1500 to 12 BC. That's the latest possible date we get from Israelites, from the Nectar Stele, from Egyptian evidence. And in fact, in this time period, there are no total eclipses, just one annular eclipse, and that's this eclipse. And so, if our eclipse interpretation is correct, we have a unique solution, this is the eclipse. And what's important is, this provides a fixed marker point for chronology. People were talking about chronology before. It's a fixed marker point. Next slide, please. So, what about the day being lengthened? Because it's not obvious from this that the day is lengthened. So, what I asked Graham Wallington to do, I said, can you calculate the level of illumination on the ground as this eclipse is happening? So this is the level of illumination on the ground, units of lux for those physicists here, and this is the local time as measured by a sundial in Canaan, and this faint line is the illumination on the ground as the sun would be setting with no eclipse. Right? Illumination on the ground as declines as sunset approaches, and this is sunset level. And then this is the illumination on the ground as this annular eclipse proceeds. And it dips down like this, and it rises up and goes like that.
And because this is a log scale, this is quite a big effect. So this is a factor of about 10, less than a normal sunset. So what's happening is the light on the ground gets less, more rapidly than normal sunset. And it goes down like this. And what would have happened would be the birds of the air would have thought sun setting. They would have started to roost, and they do at this sort of level, started to roost. The people on the ground, not wearing watches, would have seen the level of light going down, and they would have thought the day is ending, and then the eclipse is at totality, and then it passes totality, and the light rises again by about a factor of 3 or 4 or 5, and then finally sets. So it's like one day has ended, and another day started, and then the other day ends. So it's as if the day has been lengthened. Next slide, please. So it's like a double dusk day. So the first dusk is at the maximum of the eclipse, which happened at 4:50 p.m. in the afternoon. And the illumination of the ground was then 10 times less than the normal illumination. The birds would have roosted. And then the light level rose again before second dusk at the normal sunset at 5:38. So it would have appeared that they would have been lengthened so the Israelites could complete their victory. The next slide shows the appearance of the sun at 3-minute intervals during this eclipse. So this is calculated appearance. Here's the sun being eclipsed more and more and more and more. In his totality, we have this thin rim of the sun visible, and then the sun increases in size again. At this point, it appears to people on the ground that evening has approached very fast. Think the day has ended, they need more time to finally complete the battle, and lights up again and they can complete the battle. Next slide, please. So we have this now a fixed date in the calendar. And I want to now say what we can use this fixed date for to date other events. So let's start by looking at Egyptian pharaohs. So mainstream Egyptologists have these dates for the reigns of Ramesses II, and these are the dates, for example, Kenneth Kitchen, who's been mentioned, who I'm greater fan of. These are the dates, for example, that Kenneth Kitchen believes in, and the mainstream Egyptologists believe in. And Kenneth Kitchen has said that these dates have an uncertainty of plus or minus 10 years. Right? So that's the maximum uncertainty in those dates. The maximum possible uncertainty is plus or minus 10 years. A question asked about the new chronologists, David Rawls, would say 300 years later than this. But David Rawls' dates, they're totally ruled out by the radiocarbon dating I showed before. So the radiocarbon dating I showed before is in alignment with these dates. And totally rolls up also the dates of David Rock. So, you know, you have scientific evidence that he can't be right. I mean, I appreciate what he's done. He's a person who's brought in new ideas, he's challenged people's thinking, that's very good, but he isn't correct. So, can we use the Joshua eclipse to refine the dates of Egyptian pharaohs? So, there's three key inputs we can put into this. The first is, we know from the radiocarbon dating that the latest possible date, the first year of the reign of Menetrer, is 1207 BC, 95% probability. The Egyptologists say 1203 BC, but let's stick with the science here. Very close. The Menetrer stela was erected in his fifth year, and it says that he conquered the people of Israel in Canaan sometime in that period. Now, Kenneth Kitchen actually has narrowed this down, and he says it has to be in years 2 to 4 of Menetrer on this Menetrer stele. And I think Kitchen is correct. But I'm just going to ignore that bit at the moment and come back to it. And then the third bit of evidence, if you take the evidence, is the Joshua eclipse on 3rd of October 25th BC means that he entered Canaan earlier that year. So this pinpoints the conquest, it pinpoints when Joshua entered Canaan. So those are the three key bits of evidence, and if you go to the next slide, please. We can say that if Israel entered Canaan in 12,007 BC, that's the earliest possible date for Menetrer to have defeated them in Canaan. If he defeated them in year 5, then the earliest possible year was year 1, was adding 5 years to that inclusively, was 1211 BC. On the other hand, if Israel entered in his year 1, then the latest possible date for his year 1 was 1207 BC. So that's the earliest possible date, that's the latest possible date. So the first Manetta was 12,009 plus or minus 2 years. If you take Kenneth Kitchen's statement, he believes it had to be in year 2 to 4 of Manetta's reign on this ceiling, then this would be plus or minus 1 year. And I think we can do that. So actually, we can date Manetta to plus or minus 1 year. And this then becomes the dates when Manetta reigned, from 12,009 to 1199, because we know he reigned for 10 years from other evidence. So we can now date into plus or minus 2 years, accepting Kitchen plus or minus 1 year. And then we can then say he reigned after Ramesses II died. So these are now the refined dates of Ramesses II. We've refined the start date. It was 1279 as a standard Egyptologist date, but as a plus or minus 10 year possible error in that, Kenneth Kitchen says. We said, okay, we shifted by just 4 years, 1275, and then this reign period, plus or minus 2 years, or take the Kitchen viewpoint, just plus or minus 1 year. And so we now got really accurate dates for these two key pharaohs, and also for some other pharaohs before them and after them. And if you accept this, his lunar eclipse, these are the most accurate dates available. We've gone from plus or minus 10 years to plus or minus 2 years, or I think probably plus or minus 1 year. Next slide, please. Now let's look at some other verse which I took Alan Millard's opinion on. And there's this curious verse in Joshua, much later on in Joshua, where God is speaking to Joshua, and he says, I sent the hornet ahead of you, which drove them out before you, also the two Amorite kings. You did not do it with your own sword and bow. So what God is saying to Joshua is, you went to Canaan, and you swept through the land. You conquered them very, very rapidly. And God is saying, that is because I sent something before you to do this. You did not do it with your own sword and bow. Something happened, the hornet happened, and the Israelites just sort of cleared up afterwards, as it were. And so the question is, what is the meant by this Jewish word, Hebrew word, which was translated in some translations hornet? If you go to Septuagint, this is the Greek version of the Hebrew Old Testament, composed by scholars in Alexandria, Jewish scholars in Alexandria in Egypt in the 2nd, 3rd centuries BC. The Septuagint has horse instead of hornet. John Garstang, who Alan mentioned, argued that the hornet meant Egypt. And he argued that because there was a hieroglyph of a bee which the king of Lower Egypt adopted as his symbol. And so Manetta's army would have gone in, and on their uniform, they would have had this hieroglyph of a bee. So I've looked at this hieroglyph of a bee, and it's a bit stylized, but it could well be a wasp or a hornet. I mean, it looks a bit more like a hornet than a bee. So I think this is a very good interpretation. I agree with Garstang. And so if you accept that, then when Joshua says, I sent the hornet ahead of you, it's a sort of code language to say, I sent the Egyptian army ahead of you to, you know, who drove these your enemies out before you. And so this fits then, at the age of Joshua and in Canaan in 12,007 BC, so that's a marker, an absolute date. And Manetta conquering the cities in Canaan in his first few years, he came in, I think, in 12,009. So, you know, he had a couple of years to go through and have some major victories ahead of Joshua entering. And what is interesting is in Kenneth Kitchen's wonderful book called On the Reliability of the Old Testament, he says, I've got a theory. He says, I have a theory that Joshua was a contemporary of Manetta's forces. Joshua was a contemporary of Manetta's forces' intrusion into Canaan. And so what we're saying here, our eclipse just gives direct evidence for this. The Manetta was there for 2 years before. He has this stele saying who is defeated, so he's gone through Canaan, defeating all these peoples.
He claims to have defeated Israel, probably an exaggeration, as Alan says, so he probably didn't defeat Israel. But the Israelites then came along afterwards, and they just were easily able to move through Canaan because the main people there had been defeated already by the Mentor. Next sentence. We've recently, fairly recently, published this in an astronomy journal, and I published it there deliberately because it's important to get the astronomy verified by peer-reviewed astronomers. I believe it's the oldest datable solar eclipse recorded in the world, in any literature. That's what they said in this paper, which is remarkable. So if you accept this, then the Old Testament has the oldest recorded datable solar eclipse. I suggest it enables us to correctly interpret this puzzling passage in Joshua about the sun standing still. It's a poor translation. It enables us to refine the brain dates of key Egyptian pharaohs, Ramesses II and Nectar, to plus or minus 2 years, or plus or minus 1 year. And so this is the paper we published. Solar eclipse of 1207 BC helps date pharaohs. We published in Astronomy and Geophysics Journal in 2017. I was really concerned because it's quite hard to get biblical papers published in science journals. And actually, I should say, I sent this to, I thought because it's multidisciplinary, I sent it to Nature to start with, and within 12 hours, Nature replied. It's just the editor saying, we don't accept biblical papers. Right? I then sent it to Science, which is the other sort of leading journal, and their response I thought was very considered. So it went to the astronomy editor of Science, and he said, I've discussed this with four other editors, and we've thought about it very carefully, and we cannot accept biblical data as scientific data, right? And so we cannot publish it. But I thought that's a very considered response. I didn't try to argue. I said, I accept your response, but as you know, we've published solar eclipse papers based on observations of Babylonian priests who were great astronomers then. And I also say we published data published by people from monasteries in the Middle Ages, which are accepted as really good scientific data. These people were very trained observers. And so I said, so why don't you, you know, accept this as a simile? But anyway, you can't win all arguments. But anyway, this journal published it, which is very nice. But what is interesting is, we're actually saying if you accept this interpretation, it's not saying, you know, you're looking to Egypt to confirm the Bible. You're actually saying that biblical history enables us to refine the history of ancient Egypt in this case, and refine the dates of ancient pharaohs. And just to finish by now coming to the dates of the conquest and the Exodus. So if you accept what has been done, then the Joshua eclipse gives an absolute date for the conquest of 1007 BC. And if we say the Exodus was 40 years before the conquest, then the date, as the Bible says, and of course it's a question of whether it's meant to be literal or not, but if we take it as being literal at the moment, then the date of the Exodus was 1247 BC, in the reign of Ramesses II, and that's a new date for Ramesses II, you know, very, very firmly in the in the middle of his reign, towards the start of his reign, in the middle of his reign. Next slide, please. And if we've just got 5 minutes, I'll just comment on the debate about the date of the Exodus, because many of you will know scholars have a number of dates, but there are two main dates which they hold. I'd just like to comment on those. So two main dates are based on two main texts in the Old Testament. One is that the Egyptians put slave masters over the Israelites, oppressed them with forced labour, they built Python and Ramesses as sources of Pharaoh. And Alan Miller has just commented on Python, and I'll comment in a moment on Ramesses. So that gives you a late date, the Exodus, about 1280, say, BC. And then there's an early date, the Exodus, which says in the 480th year after the Israelites out of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, he began to build the temple of the Lord. That's from 1 Kings 6:1. And we know when Solomon began to build the temple, and if you take the 480 years, you get back to 1446 BC, so that's a high date. So we have these two dates, apparently both based on good pieces of scripture. Next slide, please. So let's just look at when Ramesses was built. I'll skate on this quite quickly. We know from archaeology, ancient Ramesses is now modern Kantir. Egypt's capital in the Nile Delta. It was started by Cephas I and then mainly built by Ramesses II. The time before that, when people were settled here, was these foreign pharaohs called the Hyksos pharaohs, and they were settled in the Nile Delta at the same place as well, in that time period, 1648 to 1540 was the time period of these Hyksos pharaohs. And everyone agrees that's too early to get to this. So basically, there's been no capital, in the Nile Delta from Hyksos to Cephas I. And so if you take this and you say that the Israelite slaves are building the palaces of Ramesses, then it rules out this date because there was no capital there and Ramesses II wasn't living at that time. So that rules out this high date. So I sort of said that. So the earliest possible date for the Exodus is when Ramesses II is a pharaoh. If we go on to the next slide, please. This is the 480 years evidence. Solomon began to build the temple 480 years after the Exodus from Egypt. We know Solomon's temple started in around 996 BC, so the date of the Exodus will be around 1446 BC. Next slide, please. So the key question then is, what did the writer of Kings mean by 480 years? And if it's a literal 480 years, you get back to 1446 BC. Is there another equally valid meaning? And how did ancient civilizations date past events? And we know the ancient Egyptians and the Greeks, they counted generations. And we do this today. We will say, if you're tickling to your children, they say, this event happened when your grandfather was alive. This happened when your great-grandfather was alive. And people did that much more in ancient times. So you counted back in generations. And each generation was taken to be a nominal 40 years. And I compare that with the length of a foot. So you know we have a length of a foot which is based on a human foot, but nearly all your feet are less than a foot in length. My foot is about a foot in length, right? So so when we get a measure of a foot, make sure you're not, you know, you're not cut short when you're buying some ancient bit of cloth or something. So when they talk about foot, they're measuring a person's foot and a big foot. So in the Old Testament, although each generation was nominal 40 years, that was a maximum time between the birth of the father and the birth of their son. But in practice, it was less than that, in the same way that the practice of length of your feet is less than 1 foot. And you see this all over the Old Testament. For example, for 40 years, I was angry with that generation. You know, 40 years in a generation is sort of interchangeable. Next slide, please. So 480 years could be 12 generations by nominal 40 years. Evidence to support this of Septuagint, who says there's 440 years between the Exodus and the building of Solomon's temple, and therefore 40 years suggests they have 11 generations of 40 years. And when you work out the generations, it's quite easy to see how you can make a mistake getting the generations when you count them back. Next slide, please. And you can get the generations from the Old Testament because we know the genealogy of the high priests, and they probably didn't miss out high priests easily. And we know that Aaron was a high priest of the Exodus, Azariah was a high priest in the temple that Solomon built, and we can go through these generations, and if you count carefully, and I think they're given in three different places you have to put them together, there are exactly 12 generations from the Exodus to build the temple. So there is this quite strong evidence that the 480 years is 12 generations of nominal 40 years. If you go to antique shops and say, what's a generation, because they count in generations, they'll tell you today, going back in time, you know, a few centuries, it's 30 years. By the time of the Exodus, the scholar Bright says in the history of Israel, it's 25 years. So if Bright is correct, 12 generations of 25 years is 300 years, not 480 years. And Kenneth Kitchin, in his classic book on the land of the Old Testament, says a generation between 22 and 25 years. So he's looked into this generation. And so that's his estimate of generation. Next slide, please. So when was the date of the Exodus? Well, if we take Bright's 30 years of generation, the Exodus took place in 966, which was the building of Solomon's Temple, plus 300 years, which is 12 times 30, and that takes us to 1266 BC. Or if you take Kitchen's 22 to 25 years, it's in the range, I think, about 1260 to up to 1250 BC. Again, the reign of Ramesses II, and that fits in the building of Ramesses, and it's a consistent story, and by date, the Exodus is actually 1247 BC. It's very close to this. So the One Kings reference on this interpretation actually fits well with the reference to the Israelites building the store cities for Ramesses. So Joshua eclipsed ancient Exodus, conquest in 1207 BC, Exodus in about 1247 BC, if the Exodus was 40 years before. Kitchen's date was this, and that date's very close. If we look in terms of generations, a 1247 BC eclipse for the Exodus, consistent with a generation being 23 years, which fits with Kitchen independently saying 22 to 25 years. But the Joshua eclipse date is a very independent way getting to this 1247 BC, we just go from conquest and 40 years. It's very close to Kitchen's lower date of 1250 BC. So what I want to say is we've got a really consistent story in this. Next slide, please. Was the eclipse a miracle? So we explained it in terms of science. We have not explained it away. It's a wonderful miracle of timing that God, that there was this eclipse at the time of Joshua, who was trying to win this battle and then occupy Canaan as soon as possible. And it was a normal eclipse of the sun. In other words, the fact is we can retro-calculate it. So God didn't tweak the orbit of the sun. He didn't tweak the orbit of the moon. And so for this miracle to happen at this time, the only way scientifically I can think of this is it was actually prearranged by God before the foundation of the world. And that's a remarkable thought if you think about it. Right? So I think the conclusion that I come to from this, and also from things like the Star of Bethlehem, and also from what I think is a lunar eclipse on the evening of the crucifixion, is that these events were prearranged by God before the foundation of the world, and the Bible talks about Jesus being slain before the foundation of the world. And so, you're forced to the viewpoint, I think, if you accept this, that God has got a fixed framework for our universe, in which certain effects like this, like Jesus was born in a certain place at a certain time, and that was fixed before the foundation of the world. But I think within that there's flexibility, so there's a fixed framework. There has to be flexibility within that, or else prayer is meaningless. And so, we live our lives in flexible circumstances, but fixed times, and Jesus' return is expected at a fixed time as well. And God is overall in charge. But events like this, I think, do, to me, suggest that God really has planned these key events where this wonderful miracle showed that Joshua was chosen by God very much, and then this miracle assisted in the conquest of Canaan. And so the other point is that you can imagine the news of this eclipse, and people have seen it throughout Canaan. People have seen this eclipse, and they would have heard about Joshua being successful in battle, and it would have terrified the other people of the Israelites' fault. You know, it's like, I discussed this with Adam as well, it's a bit like ISIS or Daesh. You know, they swept through Iraq and Iran, even though their forces weren't great, and that was they had these initial victories where they said, God's on our side, and people were terrified. And I think it was similar to the ancient Israelites then. God was on their side because of this eclipse, and it just swept through Canaan. Next slide, please. Last slide. So, I suggest, as honest as still, should now be at least a footnote in Bible saying, problem interpretation. This is a fact. There was a solar eclipse as from Canaan in 1210 BC. That is a fact, whether you believe the interpretation or not. It is the oldest recorded solar eclipse, if you do believe the interpretation. It enables us to date the Egyptian pharaohs to plus or minus 2 years, or probably plus or minus 1 year. Gives an absolute date for the conquest. Gives an absolute date for the Exodus, if we take 40 years as being literal. And the key thing is, we've got evidence we've used from archaeology, like the Menectus Stela, astronomy, the eclipse, and the Bible, lots of Bible references I've referred to, and they agree, and they're remarkably consistent. So again, I'd end with what Alan said. I think astronomy, archaeology, astronomy, and the Bible really do reinforce what the Bible is saying, and give us new insights, I suggest, into what the Bible is saying. Thank you very much.